Welcome to the Science Podcast for November 2nd, 2012. I'm Edward Hermy.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This week, probing the quantum nature of the photon, France and Germany's universities take steps to bolster their international standings and what perpetuates poverty.
The poor in our games were much more focused than the rich. They used their resources far more carefully. It was as if they were holding a dollar in their hand and trying to make it go as far as possible.
Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Wave particle duality is the concept that a subatomic particle, such as a photon, behaves simultaneously like both a particle and a wave. A classic problem with this concept is that it is not yet possible to test both properties at the same time, leaving many researchers to postulate that the act of measuring the state of a photon determines its behavior. Peter Shadbolt and colleagues created a device capable of measuring the particle-like and wave-like properties of a photon at the same instant. I spoke with Peter Shadbolt from his office in Bristol.
Wave-particle duality is the idea that all quantum mechanical objects, so extremely small things, single atoms, molecules, electrons, photons, and so on, these systems exhibit behavior which is wave-like, so behavior similar to that of ripples on a pond, but these objects also behave in particle-like ways. So they're somehow discretized. They behave like discrete chunks of stuff which are localized in a particular place and have a certain constant amount of energy in the same way as tennis balls or bullets or something like that. Perhaps the most famous examples or experiments demonstrating wave-particle duality are Young's double-slit experiment and Wheeler's delayed choice experiment. So in Young's double-slit experiment, what you might do, perhaps, is to take an electron gun, so a source of particles. This device will fire out single electrons, and you fire these particles at some sheet into which you've cut two slits. If you place, then, on the other side of those slits, a device which will detect electrons, so a screen on which we'll see a speck of light when an electron arrives. We will see electrons arriving one by one as discrete chunks of energy, as discrete flashes of light at a particular point on that screen. And so from that particular experimental result, we say, aha, we can see these things arriving one by one. Electrons are indeed particle-like, much like tennis balls. However, if we wait for more time and we send thousands and thousands and thousands of electrons through the double slit, eventually we build up a pattern, a distribution of positions at which we have detected electrons on the other side of the slit. And it turns out that that pattern, first of all, is exactly the same pattern that we would observe if we sent classical water waves through the slit. And it's a wave interference pattern. So this distribution can only be described by a wave-like model somehow. Mm-hmm. And we have to infer that these electrons are truly exhibiting wave-like behavior. So now we have a paradox in our experiment. We can see, in one case, electrons which are truly behaving like particles, and in another case, electrons which seem to be behaving like waves. And this paradox has no classical analog. Nothing on human scale behaves like this. Mm-hmm. And it's actually quite difficult even to find analogies to describe what's going on in human terms in this experiment. So luckily for us, we have quantum mechanics, which describes extremely well and very precisely and predicts the outcome of this experiment. And the lesson that we should probably learn from quantum mechanics is that we have to accept this paradox as the true nature of reality. So quantum mechanics predicts extremely precisely what will happen in this experiment, and it also encourages us to accept that electrons and indeed all other quantum mechanical particles truly exhibit this wave-particle duality phenomenon which has no classical analog.
But obviously people don't want to just accept it on faith or based on the math. They want to test it and see if they can actually determine experimentally that these particles or photons are behaving as waves and particles at the same time. So how have people in the past tried to do this?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So Wheeler's delayed choice experiment is perhaps a more subtle experiment which tries to examine this phenomenon in more detail. So if we go back to that double slit experiment example, and we consider the case in which we're sending electrons at a very slow rate, so one by one through these double slits, we fire one electron, it goes through the slits and we see a flash of light on the other side And we do that many times, and eventually we build up this wave-like probability distribution. So we know from the first case that these things really seem to be behaving like particles. They go through one by one. We see individual flashes of light. So our first instinct might be to try to examine, well, if these things are really like particles, if they're like tennis balls, then tennis balls only go through one hole at a time. Let's see which hole the electron passed through. And we can imagine a whole myriad of different ways to modify our experiment in such a way that we can determine which slits the electron passed through. What we see is that, of course, the particle exhibits sometimes wave-like behavior and sometimes particle-like behavior. And which behavior we see, in general, seems to depend on the type of measurement apparatus that we use. So we can design a measurement apparatus in which we very clearly see particle-like behavior, perhaps the electron passing through one particular slit, and we detect it at the other side. We don't see any wave-like behavior. Or we can design some measurement apparatus in which we very clearly see this wave-like behavior, but we're not revealing the full particle-like behavior of the system, so we don't see the electron travel through one particular slit.
So you're testing to see if it's a wave, and when you test to see if it's a wave, it turns out to be a wave. When you test to see if it's a particle, it turns out to be a particle.
Exactly. And so, naively, if you're upset by the paradox set up by a quantum mechanical model in which the system is in some kind of weird simultaneous state of being a particle and a wave, then one naive way to do that might be to say, well, perhaps what's going on here is the electron, prior to the experiment, is taking a careful look at our experimental apparatus and says, aha, here Pete has set up his system in such a way that he's looking for my particle-like behavior. And in that case, the electron decides and becomes absolutely, completely and utterly particle-like. It then propagates through the experiment and gives an outcome which is consistent with what we would expect to see. And in the other case, it takes a look and says, he's measuring me in a wave-like way. I'm going to become a wave and propagate through the system in a wave-like way and then eventually give an experimental outcome. And what Wheeler's delayed choice experiment allows you to do is to test for that kind of strange behavior. So what we want to do is to give the particle no opportunity, or at least very little opportunity, to make that kind of decision. And the way you do that is by not choosing a particular measurement apparatus. So you have two measurement apparatuses which you can choose between, wave-like or particle-like measurement, and you don't make that decision until the particle has passed through the double slit. So you have to be very fast. You send the electron or the photon or the particle towards the slits. And once you know that they have passed through the slits, let's say, then you choose to measure as a particle or wave. So you're trying to eliminate that opportunity for it to cheat. And so the results of those experiments are basically completely consistent with the quantum mechanical model. So indeed, it looks as though whether or not you see particle-like or wave-like behavior depends entirely on the measurement apparatus that you choose. That's what's predicted by quantum mechanics, and that is all in support of the idea that wave-particle duality is a real phenomenon, and it's really the way in which these quantum mechanical particles truly behave.
What was your experiment actually looking at? How are you trying to further the question?
So in Wheeler's delayed choice experiment, you make a binary choice between measuring the system in a particle-like way or measuring it in a wave-like way. And over the past couple of years, there have been a number of proposals for experiments in which that choice need not be binary. So you can somehow continuously tune between measuring the system in a particle-like way and measuring it in a wave-like way. The way you do that is by taking a second particle, so a second quantum mechanical system, and you use the state of that quantum mechanical system to determine the type of measurement apparatus that you use. Since quantum mechanical particles can be in these superposition states. So, for example, in the double slit experiment, we sometimes describe the electron as having somehow passed through both slits at the same time. It's in a superposition of being in one slit and the second slit. In the same way, we are able to place our measurement apparatus into something like superposition between measuring in wave-like and particle-like modes. And we can continuously tune that superposition from being absolutely particle-like through the middle and out to absolutely wave-like.
So when you are looking at these electrons passing through, what do you actually find?
So the first point that I should make is that when we talk about Young's double slit experiment, it's convenient to talk about electrons. But actually, when we do the experiment in Bristol, we use photons. So we have a photonic chip, we have a source of single photons, and we have single photon detectors, which we use to detect those. And the quantum mechanics should all be the same, and we're still examining exactly the same phenomena. But yeah, we use photons rather than electrons. And again, much like Wheeler delayed choice experiment, the outcome of our experiment, the results, are completely consistent with quantum mechanics, they're inconsistent with models in which the photon decides in advance to behave like a particle or a wave, and they give stronger evidence, again, that we should accept this paradoxical phenomenon of wave-particle duality as the true nature of reality.
So your evidence is taking the agency, the knowing, out of the subatomic particle.
Yes, the idea that the particle knows what kind of measurement apparatus you're going to use and decides in advance how to behave is difficult to support, yes.
What are your next steps for this research?
So with this idea, I think it would be really interesting to do it in different physical systems. So we do this using photons because that's the technology that we've developed in Bristol over the last few years. That's the field in which we work. But it would be interesting to form it with electrons, as in the examples of Feynman and so on. And then with the technology itself, ultimately, the goal of the group at Bristol is to work towards building a full-scale photonic quantum computer. And that's very distinct from the kind of fundamental science that we're doing in this experiment. But I think this is at least a nice example of the way in which the two things can be very closely linked. We wouldn't be able to do this experiment if we weren't already working towards building a photonic quantum computer.
Well, Peter Shadbolt, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you very much.
Peter Shadbolt and colleagues describe a quantum delayed choice experiment in this week's issue.
What can a malaria treatment program teach us about how to address illness in Africa? Meghna Sachdev chats with Barry R. Bloom, co-author of a policy forum called From Financing to Fevers, Lessons of an Anti-Malarial Subsidy Program.
In most of the instances of which we are aware, where the rapid diagnostic tests for malaria are being used, is that a higher percentage of fevers than we thought are not malaria. So what happens is, in the absence of alternatives, either the medical providers or probably shopkeepers provide anti-malarial treatment because that's what they have. And when you have an anxious mom and a kid with a fever, you have to do something. And it has been found that the most serious condition with fevers in many places that are not malaria relate to pneumonia. And severe pneumonia, or all respiratory disease, is the major killer of kids in the world. And ACTs for malaria are not going to cure kids with severe pneumonia. One really needs antibiotics, and they are generally not provided by community health workers and drugstores.
Barry Bloom explores the lessons learned from a malaria treatment program in a policy forum this week. You can find the whole interview with Meghna Sachdev at www.sciencemag.org.
When it comes to the causes of poverty, there are environmental factors to consider. Bad living conditions, poor schooling, but what about the environment of the mind? Sarah Crespi spoke with Anuj Shah about the idea that having too little, whether it's money, time, or anything else, biases the brain towards immediate concerns, reducing focus on the long-term big picture. She spoke with him from his office in Chicago.
A lot of our work was motivated by this sort of puzzle from the context of poverty, namely, why do low-income individuals borrow money at such costly rates? And other research on this topic has usually emphasized the broad social circumstances surrounding poverty and how that leads to this behavior. But we wondered whether there might be a simpler and even surprisingly overlooked explanation for this behavior. Namely, is there something about having less money that leads people to overborrow? And if so, what is it about having less?
So there must be a tremendous body of work on poverty's causes and effects. What are some of the other explanations out there for the perpetuation of poverty?
Yeah, so some explanations tend to focus on the personality traits of low-income individuals, and others focus on some of the broader circumstances like access to financial services or education or healthcare. And we think those explanations can be important, but those explanations might overlook how scarcity itself directly influences behavior.
Mm-hmm. So this focus on scarcity, what it does to people and how it affects their behavior, that's the focus of your work. But how is scarcity explicitly different from poverty?
Yeah, and I think of scarcity as being a little bit more general. So we experience scarcity in lots of different domains of our life. Sometimes we don't have enough time to do something, or we don't have enough money to afford certain necessities. And so when we think about it that way, poverty is sort of just a very specific form of scarcity. It's not having enough money. And I think some of the benefits of studying scarcity in general is that it gives us a sort of bird's eye view, and it allows us to understand similarities across different forms of scarcity. We could take that example of over-borrowing that I talked about earlier. And it's tempting to think of this as being something that's specific to money or specific to low-income individuals. But if you take busy professionals or busy academics, as in my case, you often see a very similar behavior, which is that people often have deadlines, these tight budgets, and they end up taking extensions. They mm-hmm. borrow time. And I think when you start to see these similarities, it's kind of striking and it demystifies poverty a little bit.
Huh. So you actually looked at the effects of scarcity in the lab. How did you go about that?
Well, we tried to simulate a funny little version of the world. And so we actually had people play some engaging games where they could earn rewards. And so one of these games was a version of Family Feud, which is very dear to me, and another was a version of Angry Birds. And although these seem kind of trivial, the key feature of these games is that participants were given some resource, whether it's time or tokens or otherwise, and they could use those resources to earn rewards. We could see how well they earned these rewards based on their investment of these resources. And to really make it closer to the world, we basically made some people poor and some people rich. Now, that's not something you can actually do in the world, but you can do it in the lab. And so some people had very little time or very few tokens, and some people had a lot of time or a lot of tokens. And then there was another wrinkle, which was that we gave some people the ability to borrow their resources at very high rates. We basically became the loan sharks in the lab. And others were not allowed to borrow, so their budgets were less flexible. And the question was, well, how are people going to perform, and who's going to overborrow? Will the poor overborrow in our games, as we sometimes see in the world?
And so what you found was that there was a difference between how people with tons of money or points behaved in these gaming scenarios.
Yeah, and so we found that the poor in our games, like the time poor or the token poor, they borrowed a lot more, and they borrowed at very high interest rates. But there was actually something a little bit even more interesting, which was that we found that the poor in our games were much more focused than the rich. They used their resources far more carefully. It was as if they were holding a dollar in their hand and trying to make it go as far as possible, trying to use their time as well as possible, trying to get the most out of each of the tokens in the game. And so you saw that they were using their resources more carefully. And there was this very interesting link between this shift in attention that we saw from the poor and how much they borrowed. Basically, the more they were focused on trying to get the most out of their resources, the more they borrowed from later rounds. So it's basically they're trying to solve this problem right here, right now. They're focused on it. They're handling it very well. But by focusing on it so much, they end up neglecting the future rounds and not thinking about the consequences of borrowing.
So they actually paid more attention, and they were better at the games, right?
Yeah. If you looked at per unit, per resource, they're getting more out of it. But the problem is that because they're so focused on just one part of the game, they end up borrowing away from other rounds and end up doing worse later on in the game.
So the long-term effect is a loss, but their attention gave them an advantage at certain points.
Yeah, they're locally very good, but then across the course of the game or more globally, they're suffering from over-borrowing.
So you found that attention and specific focus were key to understanding the behaviors of your study participants, but are there any other explanations for your data?
One very broad explanation would be that scarcity creates something that we psychologists call cognitive load. Basically, these demands on your attention and your ability to really do lots of things. And if that's true, then it's going to make you worse at all sorts of things. And we're somewhat sympathetic to that account, but I think we can actually be a little bit more specific about where that cognitive load comes from. We would basically say, well, that load comes from the very fact that the poor are much more focused and they have to be more careful about how they're using their resources. It's exhausting to try and think about how I'm going to use each minute, each dollar. And that extra focus ends up being the thing that sort of creates cognitive load or depletes our ability to pay attention later on.
So how does this actually stand up outside the lab? Is this something that's been seen, you know, in the wild? Has this been something that's been observed in populations?
Yeah, so we haven't done studies outside the lab, but there's some very, I think, incredible data coming from other researchers. And I'll just give you one example of a finding that I really like. which is that when we go into a grocery store and let's say we look at a small bag of chips or a large bag of chips, we typically expect that in the long run, we're saving money by buying a few very large bags of chips mm-hmm. as opposed to many small bags of chips. You usually get this discount by buying in bulk. But it turns out that some brands, some products, don't work this way, where when you buy more, they charge you more per unit. So you're actually getting a quantity surcharge instead of a discount. And there's something really striking that you see in supermarket shopping behavior, which is that high-income individuals don't realize that there are these quantity surcharges. Low-income individuals are more focused, and they realize, you know what, I'm getting charged more for buying this larger bag of chips, so I'm not going to do that. And so I think that's where you start to see an example of this increased focus beyond the lab and in the world.
But where do you see an example of the long-term losses, if you will? Is it in borrowing, as you talked about at the beginning?
Yes, there's been a lot of talk about these things called payday loans, mm-hmm. which are these short-term, high-interest loans that have annualized interest rates of over 500%. And they're disproportionately taken by the poor. And we've done some interviews, and when you talk to people taking a payday loan, they say something kind of striking if you ask them, why are you taking this loan? They look at you and say, well, that's kind of an odd question to be asking. That question doesn't quite make sense because the thing that's on my mind right now is the thing I'm borrowing for. There's no other thing out there. And so they're focused on the problem they're trying to solve, and the loan is what helps them accomplish that. But they're not thinking about the consequences of what happens when the interest payment comes due, and I have all the same expenses that I usually do, but now I also have this interest payment.
Well, so now that you have these results from the lab, are there programs or even something that people can do themselves that might change this?
So again, this is work that comes from other researchers, but I think our view starts to incorporate all of these different findings. And I think when you look at one reason why low-income individuals save, so first of all, we often think that low-income individuals don't save, which is not true. They do save, but they don't always save in these generic accounts for the future. And so they often save for specific goals, like an appliance or their kid's wedding in the future. And that's essentially them focusing on another specific demand, just like when they borrow, they focus on a very specific demand. And so you start to see that, well, one of the mechanisms that drives why people might borrow, it might also drive why they save. And once we start to understand these behaviors through the same lens, we can say, well, if we can just orient people's attention to something different, maybe that'll increase savings. And there are programs out there now that'll send you text message reminders to save or to even save for a specific goal that you yourself have in mind. And just reminding you about that goal that you yourself set increases how much you save for it. Wow. And so I think that's pretty striking.
Well, Anuj Shah, thanks for talking with me today.
Thanks a lot, Sarah. I appreciate it.
Anuj Shah and colleagues write about scarcity and attention and the perpetuation of poverty in this week's Science.
Say you're an administrator at a research university and you want your institution to increase its international standing. How do you go about doing that? Is money enough? And will a higher international ranking result in the ramping up of research that you're aiming for? Science writer Colin McIlwain explores these questions in a news focus about recent initiatives in Germany and France that attempt to do just that. McIlwain spoke with me from Scotland.
For the past 7 or 8 years, many European countries, but in particular France and Germany, have been making determined efforts to reform their university systems, and in particular to develop a small number of universities that can compete internationally with places like Harvard and MIT.
And so we're talking about, you know, a particular set of initiatives in Germany and in France. You know, what spurred these on exactly? What do these two countries think that their research institutions are lacking?
Well, there has been a strong feeling among economists and policymakers globally for the past decade or so that very strong research universities like Stanford, Harvard, and the University of Cambridge in England are important drivers for economic development and industrial innovation. And there has been a feeling among politicians in countries that don't have places like that, that they need to build places that will compete more effectively in that way. Hmm. Also, science has become so much more international so that the flow of students and staff around the world make it imperative from a policy standpoint to try and build stronger centers of excellence like that.
And so what do these sets of initiatives entail? You know, how exactly do they work and how are they different from one another in these two countries?
Well, in Germany's case, they started off in 2006 with something called the Excellence Initiative, and there was a political consensus for that, and the idea was to select about a dozen major universities and support them above others with quite large block grants and also with some ancillary grants for particular laboratories or particular graduate education programs. In France, it was slightly different. It was a two-stage thing. They introduced legislation to change the way in which universities were governed so as to give presidents more autonomy. And then later, they started on a program somewhat similar to the German one, although in the French case, the idea was to give them some grant support, the selected elite, and then to transfer them very large amounts of money to start private endowments of about €1 billion each. But there's been an election in France. A socialist government has been elected there, and that raises uncertainty about how the French initiative will take shape from now on.
Well, indeed. I think, you know, each of these countries has, you know, their own particular challenges in carrying out these sorts of changes, these sorts of reforms. So, I mean, how successful have they been so far?
Well, the German one has been running for a little bit longer, and it has certainly had a very major internal impact on the universities that have won. There's a tradition in Germany of each professor in the university having a great amount of autonomy and the central administration being very weak, and that has changed a lot already under this initiative in the universities that won support. That in itself has introduced a lot of strategic planning and thinking that was absent before, and it's made a lot of changes, at least in terms of administration. Changes in or improvements in research quality will take longer to materialize. In France, it's at an earlier stage, and there are similar problems with it being difficult to manage a university centrally, and really it's very early days for the French initiative. And it is being reviewed at the moment by the new government there.
Well, so I think, you know, this whole set of reforms brings up the question, you know, what makes a world-class research institution? You know, what can bring up the quality and the reputability of work, and can money and strategically placed money do that? You know, I think both of these schools are relying a lot on international rankings. You know, how easy do you think it'll be for these schools to really, you know, ramp up what they're doing?
There are many different facets to making an international excellent research university, and the university is a very sophisticated organism. I think that people know that they have quality if they're attracting the right caliber of students and staff. The rankings are a really banal way of measuring that. They measure the things that can be measured. So they have a great appeal for political leaders who might not understand how a university works, but they can look at a list, they can look at a league table. Mm-hmm. I was thinking it's a little bit like ranking books by looking at the 50 bestsellers that are available at the front of the bookshop. If you don't know anything about literature, then that's what you look at. Unfortunately, it's become politically pervasive globally to look for success in the rankings as opposed to look at other features that don't arise in the rankings. I mean, the rankings don't consider whether a university is democratic. They don't even consider whether people are able to speak their minds in the university, for example. They simply measure a lot of outputs that can be measured.
Well, so do you think that these initiatives will bring up the reputation of these institutions in other ways?
I think that there's no question that the initiative, particularly in Germany and also in France, if it continues, will help these universities to do some things that they need to do, including retaining and attracting talented individuals, both from their own populations and from abroad. I think that they will be successful in that regard. I don't think that they'll make a huge difference in terms of the position in the rankings, however, because everybody all over the world is attempting to do similar things at the same time, and also the rankings are inherently a little bit biased against the way in which French and German universities work, because French and German universities include a lot of independent laboratories which aren't part of the university and which the rankings don't recognize.
Of all the reporting that you did on this story, was there anything particularly interesting in here that you weren't actually able to include in the article?
Yeah, there was. When I went to the University of Cologne, which it actually looks quite modern, but it pointed out that it was, I think, the 600th anniversary of the university.
Wow.
About 25 years ago. So the university is 625 years old. And, of course, the Reformation took place in Germany back then in the 16th century. And I thought to myself, I wonder how many people have been here over the centuries and have sought to change it and to reform it. And how much difference all of these reform efforts have made. Because, I mean, the people are there, and there's a certain inertia in how they behave, especially places that are as old as that.
Yeah, that's a great question. One can only hope that the current administration, you know, has these historical records to sort of work off of.
Yeah.
Well, great. Well, Colin McIlwain, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Colin McIlwain explores initiatives to bolster German and French research universities in a news focus this week. His story is part of an ongoing series on the development of internationally renowned research universities. Read more at www.sciencemag.org/extra/global. Finally today, I'm here with news writer Carolyn Gramling, who's here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site. So, Carolyn, in our first story, we have a psychological look inside this behavioral experiment, The Prisoner's Dilemma.
Yes. People may be familiar with The Prisoner's Dilemma. It's sort of discussed often in terms of game theory and strategizing. The classic Prisoner's Dilemma setup is that you have two thieves who were caught for a crime and they're separated and interrogated by the police. And if both of them stay silent, then they may get, let's say, a month of jail time. If both speak, they'll get a year. But if one person speaks and the other one does not rat his partner out, then the one who speaks gets off scot-free. And the other person gets maybe 2 years. So it's a question of whether or not these people will cooperate or whether they will actually be competitive with each other.
And short-term versus long-term payoffs.
Right, exactly.
So this is quite a common behavioral study. You know, what were researchers looking at this time?
Well, this time they wanted to understand if there was anything that actually might cause people to choose to cooperate or be competitive, what they termed defecting. In other words, you know, ratting out their opponent based on their childhood environment. And so they created this setup where they had about 250 undergraduates come in and they told them that they were going to play the Prisoner's Dilemma through multiple rounds against another human being, but on a computer. And actually they were just playing against the computer itself. And the computer was programmed to respond to their choices. If they defected, then the computer would defect. If they were cooperative, the computer would cooperate. And so they asked them to play this through multiple rounds, and then they had them fill out a questionnaire about their childhood environments and how much violence that they had experienced when they were children, either in their families or in their neighborhoods.
So it was a look at not just who would actually choose each one of these options, but why.
But why, exactly. And it turned out that they had used both men and women subjects in this experiment, but only for the men, they actually found that those with more violent childhoods were more likely to defect much earlier in the game. And this was not true for women.
Wow. So this corroborates really a lot of other research that we've seen that shows a link between childhood adversity and behavior later on in life.
Yes. They had a couple of different ideas about why this might be happening. One of them is that, of course, a more unstable childhood could mean that you actually want to take your rewards now, that you have that mentality. It's more of a risk-taking behavior. But another possibility is that you might actually just have lowered expectations of other people. And so this is one of the links that I think they want to study much further.
Very interesting. And in our next study, we're looking at a way to fight a major problem in hospitals.
Yes, there is this nasty bacterium. It's called, let me see if I can say it, Clostridium difficile. And it causes hundreds of thousands of infections, including pain and bloating and diarrhea each year in hospitals, and also thousands of deaths. And this is a real scourge of hospitals because you can get reinfected multiple times, and it produces these spores that can't be killed by hand washing or hand sanitizers.
So it's one of these bugs that even antibiotics sometimes can't really wipe out.
Yes, and in fact, antibiotics can make it worse because they will kill the beneficial bacteria that are already in your gut.
So how is this research looking at a way to fight off this bacterium?
So one strategy that people had used in the past, because the antibiotics would kill off the beneficial gut bacteria, is they would actually introduce good bacteria back into the guts of the patients through something that's a little bit unpalatable. They would actually take ground up fecal matter from healthy patients and insert it into the digestive systems of the patients in order to try and put those good bacteria back in there.
Essentially a fecal transplant.
Yes, exactly.
And that certainly seems, you know, really icky. So I can see why people would really want an alternative to that.
It could also be really dangerous because in addition to the good bacteria, you could be transferring pathogens as well.
Right. And so what's the strategy here?
So what they decided to do was actually try and figure out, if you're going to put the good bacteria back in, what exactly is the magic recipe of good bacteria that might solve this? And they were looking at this in mice. They actually decided to take the fecal material and isolate 18 different bacteria from that fecal material that might somehow be part of the good recipe. And then they infected the mice with different cocktails, different mixes. They mixed and matched these bacteria in them. And what they found was that there were 6 bacteria when they were combined into a cocktail that cured the mice.
So someday we may be able to actually eliminate the need for antibiotics and fecal transplants, at least in this one case.
Yes. What they're looking to do is try and create a cocktail for humans, of course, and then maybe develop that into some sort of a suppository.
So that's at least a somewhat pleasant treatment.
Yes. Much more palatable.
Mm-hmm. All right. And our third story is also quite bizarre. It's about the collision between research and Dungeons and Dragons.
Yes. You didn't know there was one, but there is. Yes. In this case, there was actually an unusual paper by a father-son team. The son is in 9th grade, or he was at the time. And his father is a cognitive scientist. And they were discussing over dinner a paper that the father was working on about gaze tracking and how difficult it is to be able to tell when you're tracking the gaze if people are looking at the eyes or at the face, because, of course, they're usually basically in the same place.
So where did Dungeons and Dragons come into play here?
Well, the son had a brainwave. He was pointing out to his father that the game Dungeons and Dragons contains a lot of different kinds of monsters that have eyes, not just in the face, but all over their bodies in various places, including, for example, on the ends of tentacles. And so he suggested to his dad that you could actually set up an experiment where you would have people playing the game, the role-playing game, and basically you could look when a monster would enter the room. Do they look immediately at its eyes, wherever those happen to be, or do they still look for its face?
Oh, very interesting. So the idea obviously didn't end there with this teenager's suggestion.
No, he actually decided to go for it.
Wow.
And so what he did was they set up some eye tracker equipment, and they had 22 student participants who volunteered to do this experiment. And each of those participants would look at a character photo, a character from Dungeons and Dragons, for about 5 seconds. And then they would track where the participants looked. And what they found was basically that initially they would look right at the middle of the image, and then their eyes would move to wherever the eyes were. It didn't matter if they were on the face, they would just look wherever the eyes were.
So this is all really, you know, quite creative and very interesting. But is it important?
Well, it actually could have some real-world applications, one of them being that, for example, it could be a new technique for looking at whether children with autism, for example, are actually seeking out eyes or whether they look to the face. That would be one application for that. Of course, there is a caveat, which is that these are two-dimensional images, and it's really different when you're looking at a live person looking back at you.
Right. All right. So what else should we be keeping an eye out for on the site?
Well, one thing is that with the recent superstorm Sandy that struck the Northeast United States, we're looking for people to tell us how your lab weathered the storm. So we would welcome any input from listeners out there to Science Insider and let us know if there was any damage, if there's anything that we should know about how you weathered the rain, wind, and waves. And also, today on Science Live at 3 p.m., check out our live chat on what the U.S. election is going to mean for science.
Great. Thanks, Carolyn.
Thank you.
Carolyn Gramling is a news writer for Science. You can check out all of our news at news.sciencemag.org, including daily stories from Science Now and science policy from Science Insider. And while you're there, be sure to check out Science Live, a live chat on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.
And that concludes the November 2nd, 2012 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Edward Hermy.
And I'm Carrie Klein. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.